So in Matthew, we have the Lord's Prayer, one of the accounts of the Lord's Prayer. And particularly in Matthew 6:10, it says, "Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." I want to focus for just a moment here on the "your will be done." Do we understand that when Jesus teaches the disciples, teaching us how to pray, this particular portion is not a request? We are not giving God permission for his will to be done. It's a definitive statement. It's a declaration. It's an affirmation of a truth. His will be done regardless of you. Okay, that's really the key here. God's will doesn't require us to be done. It doesn't require our willingness to be done. And yet we see all throughout Scripture, he chooses to work through his creation. Almost as if his creation has a purpose. Maybe even one might say that purpose was designed before we were knit together in our mother's womb. By the way, did you know that today is January 22nd? It's Sanctity of Life Sunday. This is not a Sanctity of Life Sunday message, per se. It's kind of the opposite of one, yeah. But nonetheless, today is that day. It's the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. It also happens to be the first Sanctity of Life Sunday since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, which is interesting. I could ask the question. I'm not going to explore it this morning, but has anything really changed yet? Not yet. But let's go back here. Why do I bring any of this stuff up, this whole your will be done, okay? It's because we're looking, over the next few weeks, we're looking at two more judges, okay? So we're in Hebrews 11, and we're pausing because we're looking at this list of names that the writer of Hebrews brings up, and he brings up a few judges, and so we have two more judges to be looking at. As you can see in the title this morning, we're looking at Samson. Now, if you know me, you know that I have a particular love for the book of Judges. I enjoy the book of Judges. But I do not understand for the life of me, honestly, why the writer of Hebrews decides to include Gideon, Barak, Samson, and Jephthah. Out of all the judges to pick, why these four? I don't. Okay, I do understand, but I don't get it. These are not the ones I would have named. My favorite judge is Ehud. I've said that before. I've talked about the fact that everybody should have a favorite judge. And Ehud is my favorite judge. I would love to be able to, why didn't he bring up Ehud? I would love to talk about Ehud. Ehud's in chapter 3. I can talk about Ehud without even looking up Ehud, right? It's a fun story. Ehud is a left-handed man. And he was called during the King Eglon, who was king of Moab, during his particular reign. Now, Ehud is a left-handed man. This is a very important part of the story. It has two factors into the story of Ehud. One is that being a left-handed man, he would probably have been, and by the way, he also came from the tribe of Benjamin, which this just compounds it. He would have been overlooked. Statistically speaking, there should be a couple of left-handers here, okay? So we have at least one left-hander. Left-handed people are they're not normal, right? My best friend growing up, Sean Mitz, a left-handed guy, I always knew where I had to sit, you know, when it came to him, especially when we were eating. But nonetheless, it would have been considered a defect. Right? And it is. and so for Ehud, this was important, though, because in order to carry out what God called Ehud to do, the left-handed has a big deal to this. Now, he was told to create a sword that was a cubit. Okay, so a cubit, you know, everybody can do their, is it okay to say his name? Bill Cosby impression, what's a cubit? If you know the story of Noah. But a cubit's this long, okay? Which is also this long, is also the same as your femur, right? And that's the point, because the sword was then put on his right side. Because see, here's how it works, okay? So if you're right-handed, your sword goes on your left-hand side, right? And if you're, it would go on the other side. Now, in particular, it's a very small sword. It's not a dagger. It's bigger than a dagger, but smaller than a normal sword. But nonetheless, it's put there so that it would go straight down. Because the thing is that when you go see a king, and that's what happens with Ehud, he's sent to go deliver a message to the king. You know, he takes a gift and a message. And so when you go, obviously, if you're coming to go see the king, you're going to go through security check, right? Now, considering the fact that the vast majority of people are right-handed, and if you got, let's say you got some lazy guards, where are they looking for a weapon? Well, they're looking on the left-handed side. Not only that, but chances are, if you have a sword, it's probably sticking out, right? Because that's what swords do. But he's got a small sword. It's on the opposite side, and it's very well hidden. So he goes and he sees King Eglon. He delivers the gift. He knows that King Eglon is a greedy man. There's a reason we know Eglon's a greedy man, because the Bible describes him in a particular way. And anytime the Bible describes somebody this way, you know they're greedy. He was fat. He was very fat. Right? Like, the Bible makes sure you understand this was a fat man. And so Eglon, receiving the gift, Ehud says, I have a secret message for you. To which then Eglon sends everybody out except for Ehud. And then Ehud approaches him to whisper to him the secret. And the secret is this: God has handed you over. And he takes the sword, and it says that he takes the sword from his right side with his left hand and plunges it into the fat man's belly, to the point where literally the sword goes not only all the way through him, but into the throne itself. The fat envelops over Ehud's hand, so you imagine that sucking sound popping his hand out, leaving the sword there, and it says, and then the, and the King James would tell you this, the filth poured out. Now, one might say, what do you mean by the filth? Well, see, we learned this because there's actually, did you know, there's potty humor, literal potty humor, in the scripture. And this is that moment. So what Ehud does, though, is Ehud then pulls a Errol Flynn, Robin Hood, right, and goes out the window. In the meantime, the guards outside say they wait for this whole entire event to the point of embarrassment. And then they say to themselves, it seems as if he has relieved himself, meaning they could smell the filth. Okay. This is an incredible story. God sends in an assassin. He does the job. Story's over. There's no character flaw other than that he happens to be left-handed, and this is used to God's advantage. It's not even a character flaw. It's just who he is. It's a fun little story. It's fun to say, and the filth came out, and then imply what the filth is. I don't get those stories with Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah. How about even the very next judge, the judge that happens right after Ehud? Does anybody know who comes after Ehud? Shamgar. Right now, if you're looking for a name for a kid, that's got to be it, right? If not Ehud, go for Shamgar. Don't name your kid Samson. We'll get there. But Shamgar, his story is so incredible, so dynamic, it's one verse. After him, that's Ehud, was Shamgar, the son of Anath, who killed 600 of the Philistines with an ox goad, and he also saved Israel. I love that. And he also saved Israel. If you don't know what an ox goad is, it's a stick with a little metal point at the end of it. The whole point of it, shepherds use it to prod sheep or cattle to move. That's its job. He goes all Bruce Lee on them. I don't know how it happens. I don't know if he just stands there and they comically just keep piling on. I don't know if he goes in and just starts swinging, right? All I know is that he takes out 600 Philistines with a stick. That's all we know about Shamgar. And he gets this moment in this book, this time period of the judges. But instead, the writer of Hebrews gives us a list of guys who, quite frankly, aren't the greatest. They're the worst in so many different levels. Now, I know, and I've said it before, it kind of gives you that opportunity to say, but do you see God working, right? Even in the midst of, right? And we can go, look, even in bad situations and bad people and all, we still see God. Now, we're looking at the story of Samson, and I think most people know little bullet points about Samson, if you have never spent the time in Judges looking at Samson. In fact, maybe even some might even say, I didn't realize he was a judge. I just thought he was somebody in the Bible, right? But we find him in the book of Judges. He actually gets a couple chapters. And usually when we talk about Samson, we know a couple things, right? We know he's strong, right? Maybe you know that he tore a lion in half with his bare hands. Maybe you know something about a jawbone used as a weapon. You probably, at bare minimum, know he had a relationship with somebody named Delilah. But that's kind of about it. That's kind of what most people know about Samson. Maybe you know more. I hope you know more. You're gonna know more by the end of this morning. But when we look at this story, there's some problems in this story. Now, I opened up by saying, your will be done. And when we look at Samson's story, what we see is we see Samson do everything wrong. And we're going to point some of these things out. And yet, in the midst of it, we see God's will be done. I think it's important to make sure that it's clear. It's not to say that the sins of Samson were the path of God's will. Meaning that God wanted was going to use Samson's sin. Like he was like I'm gonna let Samson do these things so that his will would be done. I think this is important. It's to say that God's will was in motion, and even Samson's sin or sins wouldn't hinder that. There's actually quite a few different points in Samson's story that you're going to hear things that sound similar to other things, other good things. There's even a point where we kind of see Judas, a picture of Judas in Samson's story. It's applied to Delilah. However, I would apply Judas to Samson as well. Judas is a man who followed Jesus for 3 years. And yet, because of Judas's role within that, and ultimately Judas's own sin in there, God's will is still accomplished and still done. In fact, it's moved along in the midst of. See, when it comes to Samson, though, I think there's probably better ways that he could have handled a lot of different things. But you know what? We're not given that opportunity. And we can't speculate on what could have been, only what has happened and what exactly does take place. And I think within Samson's story, there is a great deal of warning for us, the reader, the believer, in things to do and not do. By the way, when we get to Jephthah's story, it's going to make Samson look like an okay guy. Jephthah's story is even worse. He does something incredibly dumb. Next week. For us to better understand, I think what we need to do is we need to remember something here, and that is what the book of Judges is. And maybe even what it's, I guess, not to some extent. Remember, this is during a time, and the book of Judges points this out, this is a time when Israel had no king. Now, we can understand that in the literal sense. They didn't have a literal king. That comes after Judges. That's, in fact, it's exactly what happens. Once the time of Judges is done, we move into the time of kings. But when the writer of the book of Judges says Israel had no king, it means they didn't recognize anyone as king, which includes God. When it says they had no king, it means that they denied the kingship of God. Even to the point when we do get to the age of the kings and we get to Saul, that's exactly what they do. They have rejected God as king and they want a human king. when we say the book of Judges, we're talking about a group of different of people that God brought in to take care of certain situations. But when we say that these are the judges, we need to remember who's being judged. It's not the evil kings, and it's not the Philistines, and it's not the Moabites, and all that. That's part of the judgment, but it is also Israel that is being judged at this time as well. And that's important in order to move forward to understand some of the things that are taking place. So Samson's story opens up just like so many, including Ehud, how their stories all open up. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord gave them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. 40 years is important here. The story of Judges didn't just happen over a small amount of time. It happened over several generations. So to say 40 years, that means that there are people who were born and died in captivity under the Philistines who did not know who God was in the truest sense. This is important as we look at the story. Now, this is where Samson's story opens up. The next portion of this chapter is all about his birth and his upbringing. We're going to come back to that, but first I want to jump ahead into chapter 14 because it corresponds with what is being opened up here. Again, the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Hold on to that. So Judges 14, Samson went down to Timnah, and at Timnah he saw one of the daughters of the Philistines. Remember, those are the people who are, you know, harming the Israelites. When he came up and he told his father and mother, "I saw one of the daughters of the Philistines at Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife." But his father and mother said to him, "Is there not a woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all of your people?" In other words, a Jewish girl, a nice Jewish girl, "that you must go take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines." But Samson said to his father, "Get her for me, for she is what? Right in my eyes." This is an absolute contrast, right? To say that Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And here, Samson is doing what's right in his own eyes, as opposed to what would be right in God's eyes. And this really sets the table now for who Samson is, right? We get a little bit more if we get into the next verse here. His father and mother did not know that it was from the Lord, for he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. We're talking about the Lord. At that time, the Philistines ruled over Israel. I think there's some historical context that we need to make sure that's clear here. God is at work in releasing his people from the grasp of the Philistines. What God is about to do, this is the big spoiler here, he's going to use Samson to accomplish that. It is not the Lord's will that he would marry a Philistine. Don't read that verse saying he wants Samson to marry a Philistine. Instead, it's understanding God knows who Samson is and what Samson would do. So God's going to now use that for his own purpose. I think it's so critical in understanding this morning. God does not cause us to sin. Everything Samson is about to do is right in his eyes, not the Lord's. And yet, we're going to see how God's going to use that. But he doesn't cause Samson to sin. He did not create Samson so that Samson would sin, so then he could turn around and use the sin. Does that make sense? Are we all on the same page there? Because it starts to look like that at first. Well, God ordained Samson to be a judge, and look at all the things, and look at what God's doing in the midst of all of this sin. Samson is still going to be held accountable for all these things. There's so many times in the Old Testament where we see heroes of the faith, if you will, but they're doing things that are not what God has called us to do. How many wives did David have? How many wives was David supposed to have? How many wives did God give David? How many wives did David take? By the way, the answer to that is David had too many, and God gave him one. Right? And yet we see that, and we also see ramifications of those things. There is accountability to the sin. This goes hand in hand with, remember, this is the book of Judges. There's judgment involved. Paul sort of addresses this in a familiar enough passage in Romans 6, right? He says, what shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace may abound? This is one of Paul's, it's known as one of Paul's ridiculous arguments. Because you really have to ask the question, why does he have to address this? Whose idea was it? Because it is simple enough. I mean, just kind of think about it in terms of logic. God's grace is incredible. God's grace is beautiful. And if there's any place that his grace seems to shine the most is in the midst of somebody else's failure, right? In their sin. So if that's the case, then maybe I should help God's grace be bigger. Because I'll just go sin to show how much great God's grace is. In fact, we see it so many times when people, and I've talked about it before, and I don't want to waste a lot of time here, but people embellishing their testimonies as if it helps make grace look better, more attractive. Now, if you have to make grace look attractive, you don't understand grace. But here, what the question here is, why would anybody think that's what we should do? That, you know what, I shouldn't really worry. I mean, let's face it, I'm forgiven. So is it really sin anymore? Yeah, it is. Is it still something that can separate you from the love of God? Absolutely it can, right? And that's, it's a misjudgment, it's a misuse of grace any other way. But why does Paul even bring this up? Well, to be honest, I think if we just take a moment and we read through the list of people in Hebrews 11, is it any wonder that there are generations out there going, well, look at Samson, God's grace. Look at David, God's grace, right? And it's like, so therefore, I should not worry about my sin because after all, God's grace. Oh, no, there's still accountability to it. It's important to grab a hold that our sin is never, now listen to this, is never excused. Forgiven and excused are two different things. You never have an excuse to sin. There's never a time when we go, well, sin is the lesser of two evils. No, it's evil. It's just evil. That's all there is to it. And we can never take credit for the good that God might do in spite of the sin that we have. So with that in mind, let's back up to Samson's upbringing and how Samson comes along. So there's a certain man named Zorah of the tribe of the Danites whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. Tell me if any of this starts to sound familiar. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, behold, you are barren and have not borne children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Therefore, be careful and drink no wine or strong drink or eat nothing unclean, for behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. No razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines. So what we have here is this origin moment with Samson, and we have this situation where mom is barren. Hasn't borne any children. Does any of that start to sound familiar? Well, it should remind you of at least two different people. We got John the Baptist, which is a lot of John the Baptist going on in here. But it also has pictures of Jesus involved here. This idea that this birth is not normal. Now, it's not, please make sure we understand, she conceived normally, has a husband, they knew each other. Okay, that's the biblical way of saying it. They knew each other. But the barrenness was overcome. Now, in the midst of all this, by the way, there's also this whole Nazarite thing, right? And there's a Nazarite vow in play. And again, that should even also be familiar. In fact, we see Paul and some of his guys that he's raising up, they're under a Nazarite vow. And the Nazarite vow includes no drinking, right? What is it? No drinking, no chewing, and no dating girls who do, or what, however that, what's that phrase, you know what I'm saying? But no, there's no drinking involved. There's no cutting the hair, which I always find funny, because here we have a biblical vow of men with long hair, and yet during the fundamentalist period of the church, you know, back in the 70s in particular, that was a big no-no, right? Like, men can't have long hair. Well, actually, it was a sign of complete dedication to God. And so this was also a picture. So when you saw a man, a Jewish man, with very long hair, you knew he was under a Nazirite vow. And this is who Samson is. And of course, if you know the story of Samson, you know that there's a connection between his hair and his strength. We'll get to that when we get there. But we have this picture here now that this is, Samson has been set aside. We have another word for that. He's been made holy. Right? He's supposed to be raised in a particular way, even to the point of being in the womb. Again, we could do a whole Sanctity of Life Sunday message, probably just on this passage alone, that everything about him starts while he's in the womb. Now, the rest of the story, if we continue on reading after this, starts to sound a little bit like Gideon's story to some extent, at least with Manoah. There's some confirmation. There's even some request for more information. Right? And then Manoah himself, even not understanding he's talking to the angel of the Lord, tries to detain the person by going and preparing a meal. I think it's important also to understand a truth here. Right? There's some questioning that takes place after this portion of the story. Do we understand it's okay to ask God questions? Sometimes I think we get this idea that we won't get to do that. Mary asked questions in this whole entire scenario, didn't she? She's like, wait a minute, I'm a virgin. How can this be? It's okay to ask God questions. But there's a difference between asking God questions and questioning God. Do we understand that? And that's important here. And what we see actually start taking place a little bit with Manoah and Gideon is we see questioning God, not asking questions. And just like the story of Gideon, what we seem to have here is we seem to have this family, and remember, they've been under 40 years of Philistine occupation. We seem to have a family, a Jewish family, who doesn't really understand what it means to be God's people anymore. Which really is the theme of Judges. The idea of a people gone so far away, and yet God still doing what God does. So the story progresses. Samson takes a Philistine wife. His parents tell him not to, which means that he's what? He's breaking one of the commandments at this point. He's not honoring his mother and father in this moment. And then on the way to this whole marriage thing and everything, we have this event. Then Samson went down with his father and mother to Timnah, and they came to the vineyards of Timnah, and behold, a young lion came towards him roaring. By the way, I think that's an important detail. It's a young lion. Then the Spirit of the Lord, capital S, capital L, right? The Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and although he had nothing in his hands, he tore the lion in pieces as one tears a young goat, which I don't know about you. I don't know anybody who's tearing goats either, but okay. But he did not tell his father and his mother what he had done. Then he went down and talked with the woman, and she was right in Samson's eyes. There we go with that right in his eyes thing again. So we got two different things to note. Okay, first we got the strength, right? So we got the Superman moment. But then we have this reminder that it was right in his eyes. It helps the writers making sure we understand that Samson is a self-centered man. His intentions are what is best for Samson. And nothing's going to stop Samson, including a lion, for getting what he wants. It's also important to understand that even though Samson was raised a particular way, we don't ever see him, not once, approach the Lord over any decision he makes. The only time we see Samson ever conduct himself before the Lord is at the very end of the story. This tells us about the key character of Samson. In fact, we can progress here and see a little bit broader picture. After some days, he returned to take her, that's the wife, And he turned aside and to see the carcass of the lion. And behold, there was a swarm of bees in the body of the lion and honey. And he scraped it out into his own hand and went on eating as he went. And he came to his father and mother and gave some to them, and they ate. But he did not tell them that he had scraped the honey from the carcass of the lion. What's wrong here? Does anybody know what's wrong here in this moment? He's a Nazirite. He has a vow, and that's a priestly vow. You don't touch dead things when you're a priest. You don't approach dead things. And it's not, that's not excludes, you know, it's not just like human. It's anything. So not only does he approach it, that alone breaks it, but he touches it, and he eats from it. And then it gets worse. He gives it to his parents. So by default, he has caused his parents to sin. Because remember, they're under the vow too. He's defiled them by giving them something that they should not have eaten. It wasn't clean. And Samson's story carries on, and it goes into a wedding. A wonderful celebratory wedding. A wonderful Philistine wedding. Which Philistine weddings include a lot of alcohol. Wait a minute. He's under a vow. He's not supposed to. He's forsaking this Nazirite vow left and right. Who did God choose here? Because this guy can't even, was he not raised to understand what he could or could not do? And what we see is we see Samson's weakness further when it comes even in not only how he's acting, but his choice of women. And quite frankly, if you look at the whole story, Samson has a type, right? He has a type. The women in his life are all kind of the same. Maybe not his mom, but the rest are all kind of the same. And the weakness is not just in his choice of women, but it's his own pride. Right? It's even in boasting in his strength or thinking that he's smarter, because we get to this weird moment with the riddle, right? And I don't know if you ever read the passage with the riddle. And here, for his father went down to the woman, and Samson prepared a feast for there was young men, so that the young men used to do. As soon as the people saw him, they brought 30 companions to be with him. And Samson said to them, "Let me now put a riddle to you. And if you can tell me what it is within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes." Okay, so he's kind of boasting. That's a pretty spendy wager. "But if you cannot tell me what it is, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes." And they said to them, "Put your riddle that we may hear it." And he said to them, "Out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet." And in 3 days, they could not solve the riddle. Now, they had 7 days to do it, and they find a way. But can we talk about the riddle for a moment? This is the stupidest thing I've ever read. I'm just going to be blunt and honest. That's not a riddle. That's a guessing game. A riddle should have context, right? It should have something that's normal, like you should be able to figure it out. How many lion carcasses have honey hives in them, right? That's not a normal thing. What is Samson really doing here? He's boasting, right? He thinks he's come up with something pretty clever, but he's also boasting about his strength. Because it gives him the opportunity to share a story about how he tore a lion in half. That's what he's doing here. He's goading these people. He's actually lording over the Philistines. I thought he was sent to judge. But instead, he's playing with them. Eventually, if you know the story, they convince his wife to get the answer out of him. Again, giving us a little bit of that insight on Samson about his weakness. His weakness isn't in, it's not his hair. It's women. He seems to have a problem there. He has a problem with pride. He has a problem with jealousy. Now, okay, if you haven't figured it out right now, we're kind of doing this speed run through this story. There's a lot of stuff, but we're just kind of hitting these points to kind of help us understand a little bit about Samson. And so I really want to, implore you, go back. Go through the entirety of the story. Watch how these things unfold. And so look for the similarities. Now, Samson here, he gets upset. Again, part of his character. He gets upset. What does he get upset? Well, they used his wife to get to him. Again, the first time, but not the last time that somebody's going to use a woman to get to Samson. Now, in this particular moment, Samson gives a rather crass response. In verse 18, he says, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle." Now, there's a couple things to note here. One, you don't use a heifer. I don't know if you know this. I'm a city boy. I know this. You don't use a heifer to plow. Heifers have a different purpose. The other thing is, he literally just called his wife a cow. Do we see that? Don't miss that. I know we giggle at that, but Samson's the worst. That's the kind of person he is. That's his pride at work here. Now, on top of that, where does Samson kind of get these kind of things from? Well, if we follow the story, we see a little bit from his dad. Because you know what his dad does in the next situation? Let's just get you a new wife. We'll just swap her out. Like, he has no character when it comes to women is either. We'll just swap this out. Don't worry about it. And the story just becomes this series of just gross errors. Samson, he takes this whole entire event out on the Philistines. And I'll tell you what, I'll give you this particular moment, I'll give him a little credit for some creativity. Because the way he does it, that's a way to do it. You know what he does? He takes 300 foxes. Now, depending on your translation, it might say foxes or it might say jackals. It's the same word. I know that sounds weird. There's actually no foxes in that area. They're jackals, right? But they're the same kind of varmint animal, right? The point, though, is this. He takes them, he sets their tails on fire, and then releases them into their fields and into their village. Got to give it to him there. That's creative. Right? And now suddenly we're looking at, and finally the judge is doing judgy things, right? This is what he's supposed. No, because he's not actually doing it for the Lord, is he? He's doing it because he's mad. He's doing it because he got duped. He's not doing it for the Lord. He's not actually judging them. He's just mad. He's throwing a fit. And again, this downward spiral, it gets worse. Now, eventually, if you don't know the rest of the story there, well, his wife, she's dead. He's off on the side of a cliff, just sitting there, mulling it all over. 3,000 men of Judah come to bind him. That's Jewish people. 3,000 men come to bind Samson. And there's a little bit of a conversation. They're like, we need to take you back to the Philistines. They need to deal with you. Because they're mad because you burned everything down. We're not going to kill you. No blood on our hands. We're just going to hand you. Does that sound familiar at all? I mean, the idea of Jewish people taking one of their own, not killing him, but handing him over to a different government to deal with him. And of course, if you know that story, he goes willingly. That also sounds familiar. But then when he approaches 1,000 Philistines, he picks up the jawbone of a donkey. I was going to read the King James Version, but my wife advised me not to. So the jawbone of a donkey, and he kills 1,000 men with it. I think maybe this is a good spot to stop for a moment. Because I think it can be easy to get lost. I mean, maybe you saw me get a little lost in the Ehud story, right? I get a little excited about Ehud. We can do the same thing with this story, right? I mean, you have this guy. He's a big, strong guy. Kind of an idiot, though. Maybe when you think, I don't know what you envision when you see Samson, but I think most people might kind of get that impression of, like, say, Conan. Right? Arnold Schwarzenegger in his prime, right? And then we get this masculine impulse to root him on. I mean, just this idea of taking this bone and just taking people out. Or maybe you approach the story the way I've been approaching it. Why? Why him, Lord? Why would you pick this guy? Maybe even right now you're rethinking the whole thing about Samson. You're thinking, you know, because I don't know about you. I've known a few Samsons, like literally, like people named Sam. I knew one guy named Samson. I knew several dogs named Samson. As soon as you have a big dog, it's like you got to give him a big name, so you name him Samson. Maybe we rethink that. I don't know. And if you know the rest of the story, you know things get worse. Maybe we should be seeing something else here, because see, we have the privilege of being able to see things in some pretty extreme hindsight. I've been talking about, do you see some similarities here, right? There's obvious similarities between the story of John the Baptist and maybe, you know, of Jesus, and the idea of the Jesus being bound and taken away and all of these different things, willingly going. And I don't think it's a stretch to see those images. That when the Jewish people, and I think for the writer of Hebrews in particular, to kind of point these names out to say, do we understand who Jesus is? That he is, as, and I could play the Tim Keller video that I love playing. He's the better, right? So for all of the flaws of Samson, just stop and think about some of the things that he's done, and we see how Jesus does it the right way, where Samson doesn't. I think it's worth noting. So taking the story, fast forward just a little bit. Samson has another lapse of judgment. He spends some time with a prostitute for a moment. And then he goes on to Delilah. Delilah manipulates Samson, right? She's been given the opportunity, again, tell me if you've heard this before, she's being paid to betray him, right? To get inside. And she manipulates him, and quite frankly, he manipulates her. He kind of picks up on the fact that something's fishy here, so he plays with her a little bit. And then we get into the story. And she said to him, just think about all the manipulation. All the current buzzword today would be gaslighting. How can you say, I love you, when your heart is not with me? You have mocked me these 3 times, and you have not told me where your great strength lies. And when she pressed him hard with her words day after day and urged him, his soul was vexed to death. That's his pride. And he told her all his heart, and he said to her, a razor has never come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. Not that he's lived that way, but nonetheless, apparently he's never gotten the haircut. If my head is shaved, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man. When Delilah saw that he had told her all his heart, like this is real, she sent and called the lords of the Philistines, saying, come up again, for he has told me all his heart. Then the lords of the Philistines came up to her and brought the money in their hands. They now know the weakness. They know where how to get to him, right? Now, just a quick little pause, something to learn here. The next time someone tells you, what does your heart say? Just follow your heart. I would remind you, this is what happens when one follows their heart. Maybe we could even take that moment and look at Jeremiah and understand exactly what the heart does, right? There's no love involved here. It's just pride. But again, she's done this. She's betrayed them. There's that similarity. She's been paid silver to do it. She actually got a better deal than Judas, but that's another story. But if you know the story, then the story progresses. Samson's tortured. His head is shaven. His eyes are taken. I think there's some poetic thing happening there, isn't there? Once again, Israel's done evil in the sight of the Lord. This was good for his eyes. He doesn't see anything now. He's left blind. There's another similarity there, isn't there? A moment where a man named Saul, who was persecuting the church, and he was caused to be blind. There's a lot of things happening in this story, a lot of subtext that we can apply in other places. But let's keep with his story. Now, the Lord of the Philistines gathered to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to rejoice. And they said, our God has given Samson, our enemy, into our hands. I want you to hold on to that. Our God has given Samson, our enemy, into our hand. They're giving all credit to Dagon for everything that's about to take place. And when the people saw him, they praised their God, for they said, our God has given our enemy into our hand, the ravager of our country, who has killed many of us. And when their hearts were merry, they said, which, by the way, is also another way of saying there's a lot of drinking going on. They said, call Samson that he may entertain us. So they called Samson out of the prison, and he entertained them. You know, dance monkey kind of a thing. And they made him stand between the pillars. And Samson said to the young men who held him by the hands, let me feel the pillars on which the house rests, that I may lean against them. Remember, he's blind. Now the house was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there. And on the roof, there were about 3,000 men and women. So we're talking about just 3,000 spectators, never mind the actual audience, who looked on while Samson entertained. So the stage is set. Pieces are in place. And while the Philistines are worshiping their God, the instrument of the one true God's judgment is now in place. Trojan horse, anyone? And by the way, here they're saying, our God has given him into our hands. It's interesting because their God seems to fail to protect them from what's about to happen. If their God is such a God, wouldn't that God know what exactly he has brought into their midst? And then finally, 46 minutes into a message, we get to perhaps why Samson is mentioned in the book of Hebrews. Then Samson called to the Lord. This is the first time in his life that we have it recorded. Then Samson called to the Lord and said, O Lord God, please remember me, and please strengthen me only this once, O God, that I may be avenged on the Philistines for my two eyes. Such an almost earnest prayer. And Samson grasped the two middle pillars on which the house rested, and he leaned his weight against them, his right hand on one and his left hand on the other. And Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. Then he bowed with all his strength, and the house fell upon the lords and upon the people who were in it. Remember all those people on the roof? So the dead whom he killed at his death were more than those whom he killed during his life. Then his brothers and all his family came down and took him and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtol in the tomb of Manoah, his father. He had judged Israel 20 years. In other words, this whole entire story takes place over the course of 20 years. So many times in the stories of judges, we have the judge and we have the great act, and then it says, and they. Here, this is the end of the story. And here's the first time in 20 years that we have a record of him acknowledging God. And it's a huge tragic end to a story. But God's will is done. What God set in motion 20 years earlier, after 40 years of occupation, that God put them in the first place. Now it's happening. And maybe what we do is we sit back and we start mulling over the story and we start asking, what's the moral of the story? What are we supposed to learn from the story? What is God doing in the story? And all of the different good, right questions. One of my favorite TV shows is The Twilight Zone. And when I say Twilight Zone, I'm talking Rod Serling Twilight Zone. I mean, the new ones are okay, but they're not the same. But Rod Serling Twilight Zones, 1960s, early 70s, Twilight Zones. And what makes The Twilight Zone such a fascinating show is that in so many cases, it takes this ironic twist, right, that ultimately heeds a warning. That if we're not careful, this could happen. And it's always done in such a bizarre fashion, but yet the story is something that, if we stop and we just look at the detail. Yeah. My absolute favorite, if you ask my family, they know this. My absolute favorite Twilight Zone is The Monsters Do on Maple Street. I do have my top 100, and Monsters Due on Maple Street is my by far my absolute most favorite Twilight Zone of all time. If you're not familiar with this particular episode, you have a very simple little block in a town, in a city, right? And on this block, let's just say the imagination of a child sparks a whole lot of events. So it's a hot summer day and the power goes out. Now in the midst of this, there's some accusations that start getting pointed at everybody, because the idea that perhaps, because somebody says they saw something in the sky, and a kid, little kid with his comic book, says it was a UFO. And suddenly everybody's pointing fingers thinking somebody's an alien. And some different events start taking place that cause people to spur on this angst towards one another. And eventually it leads to one of the neighbors being killed in the process by another neighbor, because they're convinced he must be the reason for all of these things. And as everything escalates within this 20-minute show, not counting commercials, then what happens towards the end is suddenly the camera just starts zooming out, and you're seeing the block from a distance, and now you're on the hillside, and it just pulls back just far enough, and there's two figures, two aliens, standing on a hillside, and they're asking the question, what do we need to take over this planet? And they said, we don't have to do anything. I'm paraphrasing here. We don't have to do anything. They'll take care of themselves. And it's just this, and I stop and I think about it, right? And I think about the Twilight Zone. And I think about even like just the past, I don't know, 2-3 years, kind of feels like we've been in the Twilight Zone a little bit, right? And I just see that, and it's like that particular episode in particular, just for me, it just summarizes this idea of what it looks like when we do what's right in our own eyes. When my rights and my space and my thoughts, they are the thing that rules the day. So why do I bring that up? What's the point of the book of Judges? Here's how you can kind of summarize the book of Judges. Israel, God's people. Israel did evil. God did not. God remains faithful to his people, even though his people did not remain faithful to him. What's the point of the book of Hebrews? It's to push or to compel the followers of Jesus to remain faithful. When all opportunity to walk away, just like so many others have, when there's a time to stop and say, I'm going to take matters into my own hands, don't. Remain faithful. When we look at all of the ups and the downs that are mentioned in the various different names of the stories that are attached to those in Hebrews 11, what we see is we see an incredibly flawed people, and in so many cases took matters into their own hands. God makes a promise. They don't stay faithful to that promise. I don't have a son, so I'm going to go get myself a son. Well, that's not what God said. God said, I'm going to give you a son. Remain faithful. And here's the thing. Even in the midst of all of their unfaithfulness, what does God do? Remains faithful. He doesn't turn to them and say, you know what, you weren't faithful, so therefore I won't be faithful. Because see, all of those promises that are made in all of those different stories all lead to the bigger promise. To us, a child is born, right? I mean, the promise of Jesus. When we look at the story of Samson, I think it's important that we don't look at it going, who's the hero? Oh, it's Samson. Oh. It's that in spite of the lack of a hero, God is still faithful to his people. He said, I will redeem my people. He redeems his people. It's a reminder that we are flawed people as a whole, but we don't serve a flawed God. Right? If we stop and we take a moment with like the parable of the tax collector and the sinner, right? You have that moment where the tax collector is like, you know, I'm the greatest, God. You are so blessed in having me. And then you have the sinner, you know, he's like, I'm just horrible. And then we go back to the tax collector and he says, I'm glad I'm not him. When we look at this story, don't start comparing yourself to Samson by saying, at least I'm not, you are. We're all Samson in one way or another. We're all Gideon in one way or another. I don't know. I kind of hope maybe some of us were Ehud too, you know, but that's a different thing. But I think it's important that when we look at this, the writer of Hebrews isn't bringing up, it's not saying Samson was faithful. He's not highlighting Samson's faithfulness. He's causing us to go back and look at the story of Samson in the right way. To see that it was God who was faithful in the whole entire time. It always has been. And at no point in time, I mean, let's face it. How many times do we need to say the phrase, once again, Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and we give up? We're like, I'm done with Israel. Let's move on. And by the way, Jesus coming, getting us beyond Israel, that's not the point, right? He didn't give up on Israel. By the way, he still hasn't given up on Israel. Israel has given up on him today, 2023. But God hasn't given up on them. And he's not giving up on you. He hasn't given up on anybody. He's never given up on anybody. He has remained faithful. How many times throughout the scripture do we see an opportunity for God to give up? Too many. How many times do we see him give up? None. Not once. So I know this was a very super encouraging message this morning. Love telling the story of Samson. I hope I never have to preach it again. And then next week we're going to look at Jephthah. I think I might call in sick next week, just saying. You know, you want to talk about goofing up. I goofed up. I mean, I would have rather done Barak than, I should have just saved my Sunday off and give him, no. We're going to talk about Jephthah, and we're going to talk about foolish things that we say before God, because that's exactly what Jephthah does. But if anything this morning, I want us to remember that God's promises have been fulfilled. The only promise we haven't seen the absolute fulfillment of yet is his literal kingdom come. So we're still holding on to that. Don't lose faith in that. It's still coming. This morning as you come to the table, this is our physical representation of the guarantee that he has given us. His body, his blood, new covenant. Not replacing covenant. Not let's throw away the old covenant, but to say this is the covenant. This has always been the point of the covenant, is his son dying for our sin that we might know the Father. If you come to the table this morning, come with only the knowledge that Jesus is faithful regardless of your faith, and he will show himself over and over again. Let's pray. Father God, we do thank you so much for this morning. And Father, I do thank you for the story of Samson. And I get frustrated looking so often at these stories. And I go, why, Lord, why? But Lord, it doesn't take much more than a quick glimpse in the mirror to ask the same question again. And Father, I know there are times, maybe as soon as just this morning, that some of us might question. Help us to learn the difference between asking you questions and questioning you. Lord, help us to understand what it is that you're doing as much as it is that we need to know. And that, Father, in those days that I don't know, faith isn't necessarily the words that are the first things that come to our mind or our lips, that you would remind us that you are faithful. We give you all the praise and all the glory. Amen.
I want to encourage you to make this your prayer this week. Arise to my help, in richness of covenant blessings. Keep me feeding in the pastures of thy strengthening word, searching scripture to find thee there. If my waywardness is visited with a scourge, enable me to receive correction meekly, to bless the reproving hand, to discern the motive of rebuke, to respond promptly, and do the first work. Let all thy fatherly dealings make me a partaker of thy holiness. Grant that in every fall I may sink lower on my knees, and that when I rise it may be to loftier heights of devotion. May my every cross be sanctified, every loss be gain, every denial a spiritual advantage, every dark day a light of the Holy Spirit, every night of trial a song. We love you guys. Have a great week.